The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. With a strong interest in last year's memoir panel and the continuing turmoil affecting the genre, we thought we'd take another look. To that end, we've invited some of the best and current practitioners of the craft, including Jennifer Finney Boylan, who published her critically acclaimed memoir, She's Not There, in 2003, the first best-selling book by a transgendered American. Her new memoir, I'm Looking Through You, tells the tale of her coming of age in the Coffin House, a dilapidated mansion on Philadelphia's Main Line. She's joined by Terry Chaney, a former entertainment lawyer who represented everyone from Michael Jackson to Universal Studios, and whose best-selling memoir, Manic, has been described in one magazine as a chilling account of the author's struggle with bipolar disorder that brilliantly evokes the brutal nature of her disease. Our third panel member, Honor Moore, has come to discuss her memoir, The Bishop's Daughter, which focuses on the life of her father, Paul Moore, the activist Episcopal Bishop of New York, who rose to leadership in the civil rights and peace movements of the 1960s. The book is a chronicle of her turbulent relationship with a father who struggled privately with his sexuality while she openly explored hers. Our moderator, Marian Winnick, is an NPR commentator and author of First Comes Love, a candid memoir that tells the story of a straight woman and a gay man falling in love, marrying and raising two sons, only to see their against-the-odds happiness crumble under the weight of drug abuse and AIDS. The New York Times writes, Winnick has perfected an unblinking unblinking narrative tone that is frequently funny in spite of the fact that much of what she has to impart is painfully sad. Please welcome Marian Winnick, Jennifer Finney Boylan, Terry Chaney, and Honor Moore.
Thank you all for being here. And I just want to take a moment to say, as a person who has just read all three of these books, I very heartily recommend them to you. It's been a wonderful week for me to be immersed in these stories. I think there's some kind of rumor or tendency now to describe memoir as a trend or a craze that has had its bright moment and is fading. I really don't think there's much evidence for this, and these three books will certainly help you perish that thought if you are having it. After its explosive entry on the scene in the 1990s, memoir really has taken its place beside fiction, poetry, and dramatic writing as not just something that aging personages do at the end of their lives, but as a vital, full-blown, and wide-open literary genre. All of us here grew up in a culture that did not feature private confession as an element of public discourse. But today, literary memoir is just the tip of an iceberg of self-revelation that includes blogs, webcams, virtual reality programs, daytime talk shows, and documentary films. What distinguishes memoirists is that they strive not only to tell their story, but to transform it, to transform themselves, to create a force for transformation, as well as to make something beautiful and true. As Honor Moore writes in one of the concluding chapters of The Bishop's Daughter, shame is powerful in the force with which it can divide us from what we know. Each of you, Terry, Jennifer, and Honor, seem to me in a way to be writing against shame, and the literary movement that we are part of seems to reflect a social urge in that direction. The veiled truths and repressed secrets and outright lies that sometimes smolder in novels and paintings and films explode in works of memoir. So anyway, I'd just like to give each of the panelists a chance to perhaps give their thoughts on this or sort of explain their book to you in light of what I just said. So do you want to start?
Oh, well, thanks. And thanks for coming, everybody. It's nice to see you all here on this lovely Sunday, or this rainy Sunday, I guess it's become. When you mentioned shame, what it made me think about is that so often stories are written by someone who was at a point earlier in their life when they were unable to tell a particular story, and they reach a point later in their life when they can tell that story. For me, as a transgender person, I spent a good 40 years unable to essentially tell the fundamental story of my life. It was something that was always on the tip of my tongue. I was, I felt like Michael Keaton in that first Batman movie where there's that scene where he's with, I forget the name of the actress, but he wants to say, "I'm Batman," but he can't quite do it. And whenever her back is turned, he's saying, and I think that's how I felt. Finally, I got to a point where I was able to come through a process to be public and to lose that shame. But only then it was as if, at age 40, I had the opportunity or the challenge to try to tell a story that for my entire life up until that point had been unspoken. So I had plenty of experience living my life, but I didn't have much experience making sense of it. I think that's one of the things that people do in memoir and in story, is to make sense of their life through narrative. And, on a good day, that's, I think, one of the great things about the genre of memoir, is that we're able to take the cacophony of life and find thread, find wholeness, find a through story, so that our lives go from meaninglessness to meaning, to story. So that's my short reaction to that thought.
Terry? Well, shame is a subject I think about a lot because it's informed most of my life. And I think pretty much all of my existence was spent battling shame. And I really had a secret life. I was an entertainment litigator for most of my life, but secretly I was battling manic depression, and I didn't tell anyone. I didn't tell my friends, my family, the people I worked with. It was my secret. And shame is not a thing of morality for me anymore. It's a life and death proposition, because I found that if I was going to remain on this planet, I was going to have to tell my story, because I couldn't exist any longer keeping it inside. It was just too painful. So the astonishing thing when you begin to write memoir is you think you're going to embarrass yourself and cause yourself all sorts of problems with revelation, but what really happens is you end up transforming your secrets into your material. And it just becomes your past. It's on the page. You don't have to deal with it anymore. So that, for me, that's how shame played a role in my life.
I think that I wrote that sentence that Marianne quoted in relation to my father, who was a very well-known Episcopal bishop and social activist who had a hidden life as a gay man or bisexual man that I discovered that came out in our family about 13 years before he died. And what I found was that initially I didn't tell anybody about this, but gradually I found that if I was getting to be a close friend of someone's, I couldn't be myself, I couldn't be whole without sharing this information. Coincidentally, I have been a poet all my adult life, and I have always written out of my deepest truths. So after my father died, it came naturally to me. After my father died and we resolved what had been quite a turbulent relationship, suddenly I saw a story and felt a story. A story overtook me, and I was able to write myself through a relationship as a whole person, seeing my father as a whole person, which had not been possible for me while he was alive. And I think what I mean is about shame dividing us from what we know is what I know is now in this book, and it was shame, his and mine, my sort of secondhand shame, that kept me from telling the story.
I have a question for Terry. Did you find that when you wrote your book or after you published the book, that in a way a difficult transition to make is from a life where you have a secret to a life where everyone knows everything about you? You know, I'm in a point now where people will come up to me, you know, in the airport and say, "Oh, now aren't you that nice lady who had the sex change?" I'm like, "Oh God, they know."
Yes.
So, in some ways, it's dramatic.
It's a little like being a superhero and having your cloak removed, and you walk around with this big S on your. With me, it's a big M.
Yeah.
For manic, but everybody knows more about me than I know. It's just an incredible feeling. Cocktail parties go a lot quicker.
Well, I have a kind of, I don't know whether it's denial or what it is, because I've written out of my own life for so long, I'm kind of in denial that this person, the I in this book, is actually me. And so I walk around in denial that people know more about me, although a man I was seeing after he read the manuscript called me up and said, "I know so much more about you than you know about me."
Oh, I hate that when they say that. I think I found that going from male to female was less strange than going from someone who had secrets to someone who who doesn't really have them. I mean, you know, our lives are literally open books, you know. And
I still have some secrets.
Thing that really... Sorry. Oh, good.
I still have some secrets.
Oh, I think I feel a sequel coming on.
No, I think that memoir and discretion are not mutually exclusive. I think that actually one of the most powerful things that can happen in the making of a memoir, and it's what Marion was referring to as having a kind of imaginative vision or writing a book has a literary form, is that there's a tension between, a kind of discretion and full disclosure. You know, students that literature is not life.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I don't talk about what I do or do not wear when I'm in the shower.
I went the opposite direction. I used no discretion in writing Manic. I thought, I'm just going to put it out there, and I didn't know it would be published. I didn't know I'd be sitting here talking to you people. I mean, I might take a few things out if I had known that, but...
I don't mean censorship. I did not censor myself. It's just I'm 62 years old, and this book is 326 pages long. There's a lot more that I've lived is not in this book.
It's also the case that Honor is writing of her now dead father, and writing about someone else who's not here to comment and tell their story. And that, I also was in that situation with my book about my first husband. And when you're writing about a deceased person that has a big secret, and you're going to be the person who tells this story, it puts a whole different frame of mind on you than in Terry's situation, which I've also been in. I've written an essay called The 10 Worst Boyfriends I Ever Had, and it was no holds barred, but that was my 10 horrible boyfriends, not my dead husbands or my dead father. So I think that, when you're writing of people who can't speak for themselves, the rules are
That's
a little different.
Point, yeah.
I wanted to talk about, these books are dramatically different in the feel and style of them, and I'm just going to say a tiny little thing about it, and then the authors can say what they want. A line that I loved in Terry's book is describing what she called the art of disclosure. Telling the truth is a dance like any other, with steps and rhythm and etiquette. The steps and rhythm and etiquette of writing a memoir involve finding a structure for the story, deciding the order to tell the story, finding the way to include the backstory, deciding what's the tone of the book going to be, serious, humorous, harrowing, character development, research. And my walkaway impression Jennifer's book is very, it's really funny. She has a great sense of humor, and you're just, you know, you think a story about ghosts will be somehow, you know, laden with creepy, eerie things, but it's really a very funny book. And I think Terry's book is the kind of book that she tells the story not chronologically, but in these little episodes that are meant to reflect her experience and memory of her own episodes. And it very much recreates the experience because you're kind of slammed from one chapter to the next, and there's not a ton of orientation in between them. And I think it really very profoundly gives you this experience. And then Honor's book uses many of the tools of traditional biography to tell like a rich social story of her family, which is an illustrious American family, and her father, who, you know, had a great career as an American clergyman, and combine this with her own sexual coming of age and like the intimate matters that we do in contemporary memoir. So even though these three books are under one umbrella, there's been tremendously different stylistic decisions made about what would the best way to give the reader the experience and to share this world. So anyway, have at it and say whatever you want.
Well, it is a dance. I love that phrase. And one of the aspects of the dance is figuring out what's the relationship going to be between what actually happened in your life, all the things that happened in your life, and what's going to be the story. You know, as Honor said, there are things you're going to leave out. Even someone like me, who has less discretion than Honor, is going to leave certain things out. Or some things that happened are not going to be part of the story that needs to be told. Or you're going to have to change people's names out of respect for them, or out of a desire not to be sued. It's like the difference between a novel and an adaptation for film of that novel, I think is a similar relationship between the lives that we've lived and adapting that life into a story. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought a lot about it when I decided what structure to use for Manic. I decided not to go chronologically because I just don't think like that. As a manic depressive, I live in a world of moods, and I wanted the book to put a reader inside my skin and see what it felt like to be manic depressive. So I wrote from mood to mood to mood. And I've had a little flack about it, frankly, you know, whether it's difficult for the reader, I don't know. I think it's a visceral experience this way, and that's what I was hoping to portray.
I have always felt that it's important to create a context. And since my father did have a public life, and since who I have been in the world is so much a consequence of growing up in our family, I did trace his life, and also because I felt that his life as a clergyman and as a priest was connected to the pain of his secret. It seemed important to, as it were, introduce him as a priest and then to introduce me as his daughter. And then the third section of the book, so the book is more or less chronological, except that I never introduce contextual information without an intimate personal story that connects the reader to that information. And then the final section is really working out a relationship with this father after this revelation.
It just makes me want to talk about where each of these books starts. You know, it's always interesting to think of where you will start the story. And could each of you just tell them like how your book opens, because they each have a really arresting opening. Do you want to start, Honor?
Well, my book starts on Easter morning in the Cathedral of St. John the Divine. There is a very loud organ. There are 3,000 people in there. We're singing some Easter hymns. And then there's silence, and then on the door come three loud knocks. I mean, and these doors are you know, four times the height of a person. And the doors that open only on Easter open up, and there in silhouette is the bishop, my flesh and blood father. So that's the way the book opens. It closes, actually, with those same doors open and him going out in his coffin.
Nice. Cool.
I have goosebumps.
Well, I think my book says it better than I can. I didn't tell anyone that I was going to Santa Fe to kill myself. And it goes from there. I decided, boy, did I struggle with this decision. I decided to start at the nadir of my existence. Santa Fe was the lowest point. My father had just died. I was impossibly suicidal. I couldn't think about anything else. And I just thought, if a reader starts with me there and doesn't leave me, they're going to stick around.
That's always been my friendship strategy, is get the worst out right away.
This book, the new one, I'm looking through, begins in a crappy bar in rural Maine, where I'm playing with my band, and I'm surrounded by characters, I guess would be the nice word for them, including a skanky girl who wants to buy me a drink, a Maine, maybe, I don't know if it's peculiar to Maine, but it certainly is peculiar. The drink is called Fart in the Ocean, which is, I think it's tequila with a prune in it. And as I walk around this creepy old place where we're playing, it becomes, I see what I think is a ghost. And that gives me the occasion to remember back when I was a child, growing up here on the lovely Main Line and growing up in the Philadelphia area, and what it was like not only to live in a house that was said to be haunted, but also to be a haunted person, a person who was haunted by the thought of the person she might become and haunted by people that I came to lose, some of whom I lost because they died and some of whom lost because... as Tony Soprano would say, they became dead to me. Speaking strategically, the reason I started there, and I did something similar, and she's not there also, I begin in the present with the fact of my womanhood established, and I'm also surrounded by other people who don't know my past, who see me as female, and who also see me as a relatively, in each of these two first chapters of my two books, I'm the sanest person in the situation, which for a transsexual woman is actually kind of nice to be seen that way. And so I very intentionally started these with other people seeing me as a kind of a relatively well-adjusted soccer mom in her late 40s. And for me that was very important because if I began back in the 60s and I was a tortured boy going to the all-male, supposedly, Haverford school, that would make the reader feel something very, very different about me. So, in fact, it's the exact opposite of what Terry did, in which I began with people seeing me as a person like themselves, someone they could relate to, and then only through flashback and telling the other stories brought them back to... I led them to someplace very different and led them back there. But I wanted to be seen as I am now to start with so that I wouldn't have to make the case for my humanity.
I'd be happy to open to questions from the floor. Yes? I see one right here.
Is there any point after the book was published where you were sorry they published it? And if it was, how did you get past it?
Are you addressing that to everybody? Or? Okay.
Only the night before. I went through hell the night before. What am I doing? What is my mother going to say? I can't believe... I mean, I was a lawyer, you know, to step out of the closet like that as a manic depressive nationally was terrifying. But the response has been so positive that it was meant to be.
I could say the same thing. There have, of course, been people who really disagree with me and consider my having revealed these things about my father as, quote-unquote, outing him. But I instead see it as an act of integration for him and for me, and the overwhelming response has been that, you know, just gratitude from so many different kinds of people for the fact of my having written it, and also some people saying it's just inspired them to try and be more honest in their own situations.
I had plenty of times I wish I hadn't written this book. For transsexual women and men as well, I guess. I mean, if you can make the transition and no one knows your past, people kind of think of you as someone like themselves, which is a nice thing a lot of the time. Because I was foolish enough to publish, you know, a big stinking book, well, I'm kind of outed forever. I'll never really be seen as a woman like other women, probably. And there's sometimes when I think, you know, oh, I could have had my privacy, couldn't I? But I tell you what, if you're, and I'll bet my panelists will agree with me, if you're a writer, what you do is right. And at least I didn't even think about what the consequences would be. I just thought, you know, man, this is a great story. I'm loving it, telling this part. And I wrote the book in a summer house in winter, in a very quiet on a lake in a hard winter in Maine. And sent it off to my publisher, and I knew it was going to come out. I didn't know what was going to happen with it. And then I was in line with my children and my partner at Space Mountain in Disney World, and the phone rang, and it was a producer from the Oprah Winfrey Show, and they said, we want to put you on the show. And I said, well, we're actually at Splash Mountain right now, or Space Mountain. And when they said, when will we be back? I said, we'll be back Saturday night. They said, okay, the crew is coming Sunday morning.
Yeah.
So... And so that's how I made that decision, you know. So there are times I think when I wish that I'd kept my mouth shut. But on the other hand, and I think this is true for all of us, there are no good role models about for people who suffer from manic depression, or people whose fathers were gay, or people who were transgender, and all the other things that are at the hearts of memoirs. There's so few people to look to. So I feel like, okay, it would have been nice to have my privacy, but on the other hand, it's good work to be doing, and to let literature open these doors for people, to let them know that they're not alone, and that there are people who have had their experiences, and that what you've been through makes you nothing more extraordinary than human. And so, sure, there are times I wish I hadn't written the book, but mostly I think, you know, it's a good thing to do.
I'll answer the question too. I had two different times with First Comes Love that I had a hard time. One is that I got a lot, my book details a lot of my own bad decisions and bad behavior. I mean, you can read this book and go, God, that Marion Winnick is such an idiot. No wonder all these bad things happen to her, you know. And also very self-destructive, IV drug abuse, and, you know, plenty of things that no one thinks are good. So a lot of the reviews of my book were very ad hominem. They were not reviews of my book. They were reviews of me. And I'm very sensitive. So it was hard for me to read article after article about what a jerk I was and that they should take my kids away from me. That was tough. And then I had a hard time with television. I loved talking about my book in settings like this with readers and other writers where we can talk about the books as books. But when I became like the poster child for AIDS Widow on daytime talk shows and was paired with other people whose situations... for example, when I was on Oprah, I was with women who had been married for decades to men that suddenly turned out to be gay. And so when Oprah introduced me, she said, and you went and looked for someone who was gay. Like, well, not really. It was just so awkward that I was positioned as this freak of nature type thing rather than, you know, I don't know. I saw my story as being much more from the inside. So anyway, there were moments. But, you know, this book was published 12 years ago, and now my sons are 20 and 18 years old, and they've read this book. And, you know, that's been one of the great things for me to have preserved such a detailed record of their father. and have done it at the time when my memories were fresh enough and real enough that he's really in that book, and they can know him now and know how they got here in a way that wouldn't, you know, there was no other way, and the story was for them too, I guess. So anyway, here in the front row, we have a microphone for you.
I'm interested in the process of writing your books. It seems like you all have a dedication to telling the truth, and yet memory can be faulty. So when you get to places where you may have to reconstruct dialogue, or maybe for artistic purposes, switching the sequence of events could enhance the point you're making. What kind of struggles, did you have struggles with issues like these, and how did you sort of draw the line between moving things around for artistic purposes and finding out where the line was that you wouldn't cross because it would make it too untrue?
The book is generally in chronological order, and when it's not in chronological order, it's when memories come into the present time and so on. I did not switch any order of things around in order to make it more dramatic and change sort of the essence of the story, the facts of the story in that way. And one thing that I discovered which fascinated me was that I would write things from memory, and then I was very fortunate. I had diaries and letters and quite a lot of documentation, and I generally found that I remembered things correctly. And so I actually think memory can distort, but I also think memory can be accurate.
Well, I had an unusual struggle with that because I had electroshock therapy 12 times, and what little memory I had before that really vanished. So I spent a lot of time reconstructing my life, and it turned out to be very valuable in the writing process, to my surprise. But, you know, putting the pieces together and asking people what happened and looking at old photos and... But I do, you know, I do think that I don't believe there's 100% accuracy in anyone's memory. So I don't know if it's a bad word now to say, you know, I believe in the emotional truth. I don't know if emotional truth is now branded for the rest of all time. But I think it's important to stick for my book. Sticking to what I remembered of the moods was what really was critical, and that I could remember with dead-on accuracy.
Can I just add a tiny thing? I think that memory is memory, and documentation is documentation. And I think what's really important is to stick to what you remember and not to change what you remember.
I think emotional truth should not be a dirty word. In fact, I think memoirists and their readers, we all ought to give ourselves a break here, because the memoir, I believe anyway, is a hybrid form, and that's, guess what, that's the good thing about it, you're reading the story of someone's life, but it's an impression of a life. As Frank McCourt says, it's, you know, and you know, no one ever yells at Renoir or at Chagall, because those, you know, that guy didn't really float above that house, did he? Mm-hmm. You know, or those water lilies don't really look like that. When you read a book like this, when you read a book like this, there is a covenant that is established between the reader and the author, and I think the reader should know that this is not the same as 60 Minutes. On the other hand, the author cannot invent things hand over fist. And so you have to meet in the middle and accept the fact that some of, at least speaking for myself, that I would invent dialogue as best I could when I didn't have a record of it, and that I would present things as they happened, as best I could, except that sometimes I did say that two events happened on the same day when they happened a week apart, or I reordered the events. And guess what? The very first page of the book says exactly what I did and where I did it. And so it's not like I'm trying to get away with anything with a reader. And so this ought to be something that we're rightly proud of. I think memoirists and writers in general ought not to be in the business of apologizing for having an imagination.
Thank you.
Yeah. We can take another couple of questions. I don't know. Pick me. Okay. Wait for the microphone.
Hi. I would just like to hear why each of you wrote what you wrote. And if you could just speak a little bit to what it is inside of you that makes you write these kinds of things. Thanks.
I'm a writer, and I have a habit of working things, putting things on paper. And so, and I especially put things on paper when things are confusing or muddled or painful or beautiful, extraordinary or beautiful, or sometimes just what the room looks like on a morning. And also I find that poems and essays and books, they sort of come into me like with a kind of intensity. And the only way I can resolve that intensity or get through it is I have to write it.
Well, my life is pretty chaotic as a manic depressive, and I wrote to give it structure and to give it order and meaning. And seeing it on the page made it real in a way that, if this makes any sense, living it did not. I needed the tangible proof of my life sometimes so that I wouldn't try to end it.
Well, I'd like to say that I wrote my work because I was motivated by an urge for social justice for transgender people. It's true that when I was growing up, there was nobody to look to except for, what, Renee Richards, maybe? You know? Or even Jan Morris, people who I felt I had nothing in common with. Turns out there's like 40, 50,000 transsexual people in this country, which is, could fill a city the size of Portland, Maine, which would actually be an interesting thing to try to do. But where were they? Who were these people? Guess what? And the people that I would see on TV were always these kind of deranged circus freaks, or people who would offer themselves up to be beaten up on some talk show. And I kept thinking, where are all the people like me? So, like I said, I'd like to be able to say that I wrote this book because I wanted there to be something for people to look to and let people who aren't transgender read a book in which they recognize someone like me as a human being. But in fact, the real reason I wrote the book was because I had all these really cool stories, and I thought, oh, this would be really, it was really funny when so and so said that. And so I wrote it because, and this is the same reason that Honor was saying, because I was always a writer. I was never not a writer. So just kind of generating malarkey is what I do. and that's how I did it.
I just wanted to say that there's a part of your book, the story about that party that you went to in high school where the girl came up and you played the piano and the girl who later died came up and touched you. And
yeah.
I mean, that story was... to me, encapsulates a lot of real reasons why we do this, because all these things that are gone and a you that's gone and she's gone and were so not just alive to you but alive to me and to everyone. And that was an incredibly vivid and touching story about things that are so far gone. And
yeah, thank you. I mean, one of the things that you do in as we write these memoirs, is we also capture a place in time. For me, it was the main lines, circa 1974. God bless its pointed little head. There's most of I'm Looking Through You takes place out, in the Philadelphia suburbs with. And my family was not particularly wealthy, but I was surrounded by people who were, and trying to fit in. And that story that you're referring to takes place at a debutante party among the quality, and trying to fit in with them. I think we all have a variation on that story, that we, as writers, we are separate, we are different, simply from the fact that we're hardwired to observe and to tell stories about the situations we're in.
I think I'm allowed to take one more question. Right here.
First, I want to say, Terry, as another bipolar girl, that first sentence could also just invite people in and like, okay, I've been there and I'm going to be honest and... So thank you.
Thank you.
But for all of you, I'm also a writer and working on memoir. And my question is, how do you maintain, whether one has a mood disorder or not, sort of your place in the present while delving back into things that can be incredibly painful? And is there a danger? I mean, a real danger? And how do you kind of keep your string? You know, who holds the string or what holds the string to keep you present as you go back into difficult, life-threatening things?
For me, what was really critical were I'm in two writing groups, and I let them hold the strings, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. It was so important to have other people knowing and hearing the stories and keep taking me to task and keeping an account of what I was saying. I don't know how people write solo. I just think it's such a hard craft. And to really tell a convoluted story like mine, I needed people tethering me. So that helped.
The issue with this story was a lot of pain and a lot of sadness and the need to stay connected to the memory and not get lost in the emotion. And I went to a lot of writers' colonies during the composition of this book. It was because then I was among others like me, and also somebody else was taking care of feeding me, and so on. And so that was very helpful for me.
I think a great irony of being a writer, particularly of memoir, but not only of memoir, is that one of the things that motivates us to become writers in the first place is suffering, and pain. And I remember being 14 years old and thinking, I'm in pain. And so you write a poem about, how no one called you, on the phone, or you write a story about how I'll push them down the stairs, then they'll all be sorry. And the terrible irony for writers is that it's suffering and pain that can bring us to writing, and yet readers don't necessarily care about your miserable suffering. In other words, I often run into students who've written a story about something that meant a lot to them, and they suffered. Stravinsky. What Stravinsky said about Beethoven, because I think it was Stravinsky. So every time I listen to Beethoven, I want to say, you shut up. What do I care if you're deaf? So the question is, how do you get people to care about the fact about whatever you've been through? And the answer is that you have to make it a story. You don't get any credit simply because you suffered. You get credit because you tell a story. And that means that sometimes you have to look at the story as an observer. At least for me, it was true. You have to make it interesting, entertaining, but true. So that's, I guess, I think, and that's a very frustrating thing about writing, because so often it's that suffering that gets us to pick up the pen in the first place. But the reason we pick up a pen is not the same reason a reader will pick up a book.
I think our time is up, sadly. But it's been great to talk with these authors and great to have you all here. And we will be signing our books and seeing you one-on-one after this. So thank you again for coming.
Thanks to the signer. Thanks to the signer, too.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.